Are you ready to lose weight? With Effecty, getting access to powerful GLP-1 weight loss medications has never been easier or more affordable. Effecty offers compounded semaglutide, the same active ingredients as the popular name brands, but for up to 80% less. These medications work by regulating appetite and blood sugar, helping you lose weight in a sustainable, science-backed way. Getting started is so simple. Just fill out a short medical questionnaire, then connect with a licensed provider through a quick chat-based telehealth consultation. If you're eligible, your prescription gets shipped straight to your door. No hassle, no waiting rooms. With transparent pricing, no hidden fees, and no membership required, Effecty is committed to making proven weight loss treatments accessible to everyone. Effecty gave me the opportunity to try their service out, and I have to say, it is just as easy as they say it is. I filled out the questionnaire, and within days, a package arrived at my door filled with everything I needed and detailed instructions. Their website also tells you everything you need to know, and you can always chat with your healthcare provider. It really is that simple and convenient. So if you're ready to level up your weight loss game, my listeners can now get $50 off of GLP-1 weight loss treatments at Effecty.com with code ATTWG at checkout. That's Effecty.com, EFFECTY.com, and use the code ATTWG to get $50 off your first month of GLP-1 weight loss treatment. No hassles, no memberships, and no hidden fees. So get started today. Has it ever felt like you're doing everything right? You're eating healthy, you're working out, and yet your energy still crashes, or your mood swings hit out of nowhere, like a twist in a crime story that you didn't see coming. Listen, I've been there too, and what I've discovered is that many of these issues could be tied to hormonal imbalances, like a hidden criminal lurking in the background, throwing everything off track. But here's the good news. This is one mystery that you can solve with Happy Mammoth. There's no need for a long investigation. Just take the free 2-minute quiz from Happy Mammoth. You answer a few questions about what you're experiencing and where you're at in life, and you'll uncover the real culprit behind your hormonal symptoms. And the best part? After taking the quiz, you'll get a personalized recommendation to help you balance your hormones so you can finally feel like yourself again. According to a survey, after taking Hormone Harmony, 86% of women started to lose weight. 77% said that it improved their mood. And the biggest benefit? 100% of women surveyed said they're feeling like themselves again. For a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code ATTWG at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use the code ATTWG for 15% off today. Armoire makes getting dressed easy. With a clothing rental membership from Armoire, you can build the perfect wardrobe with brands that are high quality, unique, and recommended just for you. All you have to do is take a 5-minute style quiz and select items from your dynamic, personalized closet. And the styles show up at your door in as little as 2 days. Then when you're ready for new clothes, just swap them out for more new-to-you styles. So I've been using Armoire, and I'm actually wearing one of their shirts right now as I'm recording this, and it's a great idea. You don't have to commit to buying the clothes, but you can really start to explore your own personal style. Like if there's a trend or something that you've been wanting to maybe try but not commit to, this is absolutely perfect. Because if you don't like it, you just put it back in the bag and get something else. Because we've all been there. You open your closet, and even though it's packed, you feel like you have nothing to wear. And with Armoire, that's a thing of the past. They make it effortless for all women to turn heads with stylish everyday looks. You can rent high-quality designer clothing for any occasion, and it's all tailored to your personal style. Plus, you don't have to do laundry, and you don't have to go shopping. It truly could not be any easier. And right now, my listeners can give Armoire a try and get up to 50% off their first month, which is up to $125 off. Just visit armoire.style/ATTWG. That's armoire.style, armoire.style/ATTWG to get up to 50% off your first month and never worry about what to wear again. Try Armoire today. When a 31-year-old man broke up with his girlfriend and asked a neighbor to walk his dog for a few days, no one really thought anything was strange. It makes sense to want to get out of town and have some time to yourself after a breakup. But Billy Smolinski never gave his neighbor the keys to his home so that he could check on his beloved pet, Harley. Billy's family immediately knew that all of this behavior was out of character for the quiet homebody. But when they turned to the police for help, they were told the same thing that so many families of missing adults are told. Just wait, he'll be back. But Billy Smolinski didn't come back. August 24th, 2022 will mark 18 years since the Waterbury, Connecticut resident was last seen. And despite someone going to jail on a charge related to his disappearance, the Smolinski family is still fighting for answers and justice for Billy. When a person goes missing, there's a special kind of pain in the not knowing. I want to tell you the stories of those who never came home. Today, I want to tell you the story of Billy Smolinski. I'm Kona Gallagher.
And I'm Ethan Flick.
And this is And Then They Were Gone. Welcome back, everyone.
Welcome back.
Thank you for joining us here once again. Now, the case of Billy Smolinski's disappearance is one that has baffled investigators and the public for years. There have been arrests, deaths, civil suits, appeals, and even a bill introduced to Congress. There's even a small connection to Heather Teague, the woman who we covered in our season one finale, who went missing from Henderson, Kentucky in 1995. But before we get into this week's episode, we would like to thank our newest Patreon members. Thank you to Maggie W. and, I love this, Shrinking Sharon. Yeah.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah, so thank you very much to both of you. Thank you for listening. If you would like to join us on Patreon, you can get these episodes early and ad-free, along with some other small things I'm trying to find the time to do. And we did just release a special Patreon-only bonus episode. But for now, let's jump into the story of Billy Smolinski. William Paul Smolinski Jr. was born on January 14th, 1973, to Janice and William Smolinski. The oldest of two siblings, he has one sister, Paula. Billy grew up as a typical small-town boy in New Haven County, Connecticut. William's parents, Billy's dad, they were Polish immigrants, and they had a farm in Naugatuck, where William and Janice settled shortly after their marriage in 1968. They raised cattle and grew vegetables.
Where was that?
In Naugatuck, Connecticut.
Naugatuck, Connecticut. Okay.
Yep. The Smolinski family is incredibly tight-knit, which probably contributed to the fact that when he graduated from Naugatuck High School in 1991, Billy stayed close to home. He attended nearby Naugatuck Valley Community College for a year and studied auto mechanics. Apparently, Billy loved anything that had an engine, like motorcycles, cars, trucks, just anything. He loved working on them. He loved driving them. That was just the kind of guy he was. He decided that college wasn't for him, though, and he decided to get a CDL instead and enter the workforce. And for those of you who don't know, CDL is your commercial driver's license. So that's what you need to drive like big trucks, like semi-trucks, buses, anything over a certain size.
Yeah, so he became a truck driver.
He actually became a bus driver first.
Requires CDL.
Exactly, right? We'll get into that, but before all that, Billy worked a variety of jobs while he lived with his parents, but his passion was fixing cars. In 1999, Billy's parents decided to sell the farm, and the family kind of went their separate ways because, again, they had all been living together. And, you know, Billy graduated in 91, but he still lived with his parents until 99. He just
liked it. And I'm assuming that his younger sister, Paula, lived with them too. Like, very close family. But, you know, once the farm was sold, they kind of like went their separate ways, but still remained close. His parents moved to Cheshire, Connecticut. Billy moved to Waterbury, and Paula went to nearby Wolcott. Now, during this time, Billy also had a long-term girlfriend, Mary Ellen Noble. Now, when I say long-term, I mean most of his adulthood. They were together for 8 years.
As boyfriend and girlfriend?
Yeah.
Okay.
Mary Ellen is interviewed along with Billy's family in the Disappeared episode about him called Favorite Son. Now, just as an aside, Discovery has also put out a Disappeared podcast now, and they basically just like play audio from the old episodes.
Oh, I was wondering whether it was like just our podcast.
Yeah, right. I'm like, oh God, we're going to go out of business. Yeah. No, it's just their old episodes, which I think is kind of genius, actually. And the format works pretty well. So I listened to this one. And so Billy's story is available if you'd like to listen to that episode. And also Disappear Discovery, if you'd like to sponsor us, that would be great. Thanks. Bye. In any case, the episode kind of breezes past the breakup, so I don't really have any information on that. But I do know that Billy and Mary Ellen remained good friends. They still hung out, and she would help take care of his dog, Harley, when he needed her to. Billy's family also adored Mary Ellen. In that same episode of Disappeared, his father says that they thought of her as their daughter-in-law.
Well, I mean, 8 years is a long time.
Yeah, exactly. It seems like it may have been one of those situations where, like, the family took it harder than the people involved when they broke up.
See, I feel like you missed a big opportunity to,
make fun of you?
Yeah, to poke at my previous marriages and how they didn't even add up to 8 years.
You're right, that was a missed opportunity. Wow.
You're losing it.
I am. God, that was sad. So anyway, when a new woman entered Billy's life in 2003, the Smolinski family was not thrilled for a variety of reasons. About a year prior to his 2004 disappearance, Billy was working as a bus driver for a private company. And I find this interesting because he's actually described as a school bus driver. But again, it's for a private company, not the county or the town or whatever, which I've never heard of before. I've never heard of like private school buses unless it's school buses for a private school, which I don't know. But again, so he was apparently a school bus driver. And it was there that he met Madeline Gleason. So Madeline was a fellow bus driver and the pair hit it off. Apparently, like when all of the bus drivers would get there in the morning, they'd like wait around and then they'd get their buses and get ready and go for the day. So, you know, they were kind of waiting. It's boring. They started chatting and one thing led to another. They eventually started dating. But everyone in Billy's life thought that the two of them made an odd couple. Not only was Madeline 16 years Billy's senior, but she also had 5 children from 3 previous marriages.
Okay, that's a lot.
It is, yeah. And I mean, I think it's a lot. It's a big transition from somebody who had been with basically like his high school sweetheart for 8 years to all of a sudden be, you know, 31 years old. And dating like a 47-year-old woman with 5 kids. Billy's friends and family couldn't figure out why a young guy with no kids would want to date someone so much older. But, you know, there was certainly something that drew Billy to Madeline because the couple eventually became serious and ended up dating for about a year. I mean, clearly, Billy is not afraid of commitment.
I believe that would be described as a serial monogamist.
Something you would know nothing about.
Or would I?
So the pair was getting serious, or at least Billy was getting serious.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. Friends and family said that Billy was in love with Madeline, but it seemed as though the relationship was a little off balance. Madeline had a lot going on in her life. I've tried to piece some of this together, but it's a little difficult. It seems as though Madeline was originally from Connecticut. I believe her first husband was Thomas Karpiuk Sr. Thomas was from West Palm Beach, Florida, but after he and Madeline married, they settled in Connecticut, where she gave birth to two sons, Thomas Jr. in 1974 and Sean in 1977. At some point after that marriage ended, Thomas Sr. moved back to Florida, and her son Thomas also moved down there at some point. Now, if you're keeping track, that puts Billy as just a year older than Madeline's oldest son. Yeah.
Yikes.
Madeline then married Michael Gary Rapano. The couple also had two children, Daniel in 1984 and Crystal in 1985. When they divorced, both Gary and Madeline remarried. This third marriage is where Madeline picked up the last name Gleason, and she and her third husband had a son, Jordan. And I know this is a lot, but Madeline's children, well, at least some of them, do come into play later in the story.
I mean, I would imagine so.
In May of 2004, while Brian and Madeline were together, and just a few months before Brian's disappearance, Madeline was faced with a horrible tragedy. Her only daughter, Crystal, died by suicide. She was only 18. Not only that, but Crystal was a mother.
Wait, what?
Yeah. Her baby girl, Brianna, was just 2 months away from her second birthday.
Oh, do we think this is like postpartum leading to clinical?
No idea. I have no other information about Crystal or what her particular struggles were.
It's really tough.
Yeah, I mean, regardless of what it was, it's awful. Now, reports described Crystal as dying in her family home. And though I'm not positive, I do believe that that refers to her father and her stepmother's home. I believe that's who she and Brianna lived with. Now, part of the reason I believe this is because I don't think any of Madeline's kids were actually living with her. Now, granted, by this time, most of them were adults, so
right. That
makes sense.
Yeah.
But a week before his disappearance, Billy and Madeline took a trip down to West Palm Beach, Florida. The disappeared episode said that they were going down to visit Madeline's 13-year-old son, whom by process of elimination, I have to imagine is Jordan. And the episode said that he was staying down there with his older brother, which I have to imagine is Thomas, who was living down there.
Right.
So it's her oldest son from her first marriage and her youngest son.
In Florida with his dad.
Yeah. And not anymore. He's an
adult. Right.
But yeah, so her youngest son from her third marriage, it sounds like, went down to stay with him.
Yeah. I mean, that makes sense.
Yeah, Thomas, like I said, was an adult, and he had actually been in the Marines, but by this point was out and was working on the security detail of billionaire Nelson Peltz.
Okay, interesting.
Yeah.
I don't know who Nelson Peltz is, but...
I looked it up. He's like a hedge fund guy, basically.
All right.
So in August of 2004, Madeline is grieving. Billy is presumably helping her through this. And on August 21st, the two take a trip to visit two of her children. This seems significant, not only because on the surface it appears as though Billy's becoming a big part of Madeline's life, but also simply because Billy was a homebody, like I mentioned in the intro. Like, this dude never took vacations. He never went anywhere. Like, they even talk about that. They're like, I don't know, he went places with his family when he was younger, but like never went anywhere as an adult. So for him to go all the way down to Florida was a pretty big deal for him. But the trip did not go well.
Did it not go well because he was so much of a homebody, he was uncomfortable being someplace else? Or was it more specific towards her family?
Actually, neither. It was more specific toward her. Although, you know, I'm sure all of that probably played into it a little bit, but that wasn't the main issue. Even prior to this trip, Billy had been having doubts about Madeline and their relationship. Specifically, he was worried that she was getting a little too close to her boss at the bus company, a man named Chris Sorensen. By this point, Billy had left that job and was working as a tow truck driver. along with fixing cars and like doing lawn work to make extra money. So again, he wasn't a vacation type of guy. He was a tinker on cars, go to work, find more work type of guy.
But at this point, he's left the job and now he's not around. So now he's thinking something is going on.
Yeah. And I don't know the exact timeline. I don't know how long before this he had left the job. Yeah, sure. I don't know how long he'd had these suspicions. But, you know, the point is that when they were down in Florida, like he was already a little concerned. And then while they were in Florida, his suspicions only grew. Madeline was acting like secretive around her phone and was doing things like hiding out in the bathroom, ostensibly taking a shower, but, you know, without the water running, like just things like that. Later, they were on the beach and he tried to take her phone, I guess, to see, you know, who she had been calling, who she had been texting, whatever. Madeline screamed for police.
Oh, OK. Yeah. So I was going to say, you know, that's like immaturity on his part, but the incredible reaction there almost kind of proves his point that maybe there's something there.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. I mean, or maybe she was genuinely frightened that he was going to get violent. I don't know. You know, it could have been one or it could have been either, both, something like that. But in either case, it kind of ruined the vacation. I don't think the police came or anything, but, you know, that was enough. They returned to Connecticut late on Sunday, August 22nd. So they were gone for like a day. I don't even know if they saw her family or anything. Apparently, when they returned from their trip, Billy confronted Madeline and she confessed to the affair.
Mm. Okay.
So she and Billy broke up. And the next morning, Billy even told his sister Paula that he was done with her. But however much bravado he may have been, you know, trying to show on the phone with his sister the next morning, you know, he was upset about the breakup and he was upset about being cheated on.
Yeah, I'm sure. I mean, that's not a good feeling either of those scenarios. I mean, even if you break up for the right reasons, a breakup is still a breakup.
Exactly. It's not
still
great.
Sucks. Yeah.
Yeah. And he's only had like one other breakup in his entire life at this point, you know?
Yeah. And you said he's in his 30s now. Right?
31. Yeah. But everyone else in his life was like, oh, well, let's move on. Like, too bad.
Well, yeah, because they didn't like her. You said that, right?
Yeah. They didn't like her. And they especially didn't like her as a partner for Billy.
Well. So they were happy-ish?
I would say pretty happy. Yeah. I mean, you know, they obviously, like, didn't want him to be in pain, but yeah, they were pretty happy. So right after his return, it's funny, Billy, like, went right back to work, which I find interesting, because presumably he had taken the time off for the vacation, and even though he came back early, he's like, all right, getting back to it.
Well, that kind of makes sense, though. If he's that type of person, like, what is he going to do with his time off now that he's not in Florida? He's,
right.
And he probably wanted a distraction to just keep his mind off of it. And the easiest way for somebody that is like a gearhead like him to be distracted is go to work and fix cars.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, you know, I'm the opposite. I'm like a wallow on the couch in the dark type of person. So I definitely can't relate. But you're right. I mean, it sounds like the type of person he is.
Just you wallowing in the dark.
Yeah. Like on the couch for several days, not getting changed.
It's the only time you're focused in your life.
I can focus on being lazy if I really, really want to. So randomly, Billy actually ran into Mary Ellen, his ex-girlfriend, because he was towing a car on her street. So she was going out and she's like, oh, hey, Billy. She like flagged him down or whatever. And the two chatted. Billy told Mary Ellen that he wanted to take her to Six Flags to thank her for taking care of Harley.
Okay. Buy a bottle of wine, maybe. Like.
You know. The two hung out a lot, but Mary Ellen said on Disappeared that this invitation felt a little bit different. She said that it felt like it could potentially be a date.
Oh, do you think he was trying to, like, I mean, not consciously, but rebounding?
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, maybe something like that. Or maybe he just, you know, felt bad and just wanted to spend time with somebody who made him feel good, you know? Because like I said, the two remained close after their breakup. It sounds like it was very amicable. And it just seems like one of those situations where they were too young and, you know, there were no hard feelings on either side. So whether he meant it that way or not, you know, as a date or whatever, Billy wasn't exactly over Madeline. You know, it had been like a day by this point. They had been together for a year, so that's not super surprising. Early on the morning of August 24th, Billy put a ladder up against Madeline's house and climbed up to her second floor window.
Creepy.
Yeah, it wasn't the best move, for sure. Like, you know,
definitely not a say anything holding the boombox above.
It really does seem like one of those things where, like, in his mind, he's like, yes, this is, I am John Cusack in this moment. But in reality, it's like, this woman is 47 years old. Like, what are you doing?
I mean, the reality of...
You are 31, sir.
But the reality of the John Cusack moment is also creepy as hell.
Well, exactly. That's what I mean.
It's very, like, romantic in the movie.
Yes.
However...
Those grand gestures only work in movies. Like, that is stalker shit if you do it in real life.
Yes, you just come across as, like, a crazy dude doing that shit in real life.
Yeah, it does not work. So according to Madeline, when he, like, came to her window, she let him in, but they argued. He wanted to get...
Was the argument centered around why the fuck he's crawling into her window?
I have to imagine. Night? I mean, I have to think that was like 98% of what that argument
was.
So
Melissa Etheridge wasn't playing in the background?
No.
Come to my window.
Okay, no. Well, that is rude to Melissa Etheridge because that is a great song. And what you just did was very upsetting.
Fitting for this, though.
Yeah. No, it was. And that's exactly what I was thinking about. But... he wanted to get back together. She did not. She's just like, no, fuck it. I'm done. Like, you know what? Like, she was the one who had the affair. But I mean,
maybe that's part of the reason why she had the affair was because, and I'm not excusing the behavior. However, you know, maybe there's underlying reasons why she had the affair.
Right, right.
Like, she was emotionally or mentally checked out of that relationship already.
Yeah. So anyway, they did not get back together and Billy left and presumably went home. I don't know if he left via the ladder or if he went downstairs and went through the door, but either way, he left.
Just Melissa Etheridge slowly fading away.
Yeah. But Billy was getting just angrier and angrier about the situation, it seems. During the day on August 24th, because remember, this is like early in the morning that all this happened, he called Madeline's boss, Chris Sorensen, several times. Because again, this used to be his boss, so, you know, he had his number and all that.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like he's spinning.
He is. He was definitely spiraling. The first two times he called, he hung up after not getting an answer. But the third time, he left a message telling Sorensen, quote, Chris, you better watch your back at all times, end quote. At 3 p.m. that day, Billy ate at a Burger King in Waterbury and then returned home. He went over to his neighbor's house, a man named Tenley, to ask him if he could watch his dog Harley for a few days. He allegedly told Henley that he was going up north to look at a car.
Okay.
Now, this is red flag number one. Mary Ellen and Billy adopted Harley together, so she was absolutely the default if Billy needed someone to watch him.
Yeah, he's also a homebody that doesn't leave his house very often.
Yeah, exactly.
Or at least the hometown.
Right, right, right. Yeah, I mean, he's not like an agoraphobe.
Right, right.
But he doesn't go on trips.
Quote unquote up north.
Right.
Whatever that means, to go look at a car. Out of character.
Very out of character. But getting back to the why did he ask the neighbor instead of Mary Ellen thing, like maybe he didn't want to ask her again because she had just watched Harley.
Maybe he felt a little uncomfortable because of the Six Flags trip.
Yeah, maybe like he didn't, you know, want her to ask questions about why he was going up north, quote unquote, you know?
Sure.
But his family.
Maybe she just said that maybe he knew that she was busy.
It doesn't sound like that because I think that she would have probably brought that up like in the Disappeared episode, you know?
I guess.
Yeah, because I think that if Billy had known that she was busy or couldn't do it, they wouldn't have thought it was so, so weird that he asked the neighbor. But it's interesting because, you know, nobody thinks that Henley has a reason to lie either, you know? Like, he's not actually involved in this. So the whole thing is just a big question mark.
Do people think that Henley's lying?
No, but it's like, okay, but the whole story, none of it just makes sense to anybody who knew Billy. Like, they don't think he would have gone up north to look at a car. They don't think they would have asked Henley to watch the dog. Like, it on its face, it sounds like just a totally made up story. But again, there's absolutely no reason why Henley, the neighbor, would make up a story like this.
Right. So you take these clues as, you know, abnormal behavior for somebody, especially considering, you know, obviously he went missing.
Yeah.
Later, you take those as insight into what his mind frame was, or perhaps what he was planning.
I think that's a very good point. So Henley, you know, as weird as it may have been, because apparently, like, Billy had never asked him to watch the dog before, but, you know, he's thinking, okay, like, I'll be a good neighbor, you know, whatever.
Sure.
So he agreed. But Billy didn't give him a house key right away. So I don't know if Billy, like, specifically told Henley that he would bring a house key by later, or if Henley just assumed that he would, or if Billy was like, hey, there's, you know, a key hidden under the rock, or, you know, something like that. I don't know exactly what the plan was for the key, but, you know, Henley needed a key at some point. And it did sound like, you know, Billy had a doggy door or something like that, because it does sound like the only thing Henley really had to do was, like, go over, check on Harley, feed him. So the next morning, Henley went over to check on Harley, but he didn't find a key and the door was locked. So, you know, he could hear the dog inside, but
he couldn't get to him.
He couldn't get to him. And he knew that wasn't good. And, you know, Billy's truck was gone. Like, Billy wasn't there. And so, you know, he was concerned. Luckily, he had Mary Ellen's contact information. So he called her. Now, Mary Ellen immediately thought that something was wrong. Because, again, just every part of this is just completely out of character. They all knew that Billy would never leave Harley just locked in his house. I mean, definitely right. Not that type of person.
Yeah.
And then, like we said, like, he just wouldn't go up north without telling anyone. And, you know, he also didn't need a car. So nothing about this made any sense to them. And his parents immediately called Waterbury police. But because Billy was an adult and because he had told his neighbor that he was going out of town for a few days, they told the Smolenskis that they needed to wait 3 days before they would consider him actually missing. I do think that that initial reaction by the police does kind of make sense, because he did specifically tell somebody he was going out of town.
Yeah, agreed.
And even though it is weird that the dog was there, he didn't leave the key, et cetera, like, his truck was gone. I mean, you know, he said he was going to be out of town. Like, the logical conclusion is that he's just out of town and he'll be back in a few days, like he said.
Yeah. And to the point of he has cars, maybe it was a specific car he was looking to buy.
Yeah, exactly. Because, so, again, he loved cars. So maybe there was some just, like, magical car that he fell in love with up north that he really wanted to go see.
Yeah, I mean, you're not a car person, so.
I'm not. And I don't care about cars. I think they're dumb. But, like, again, I do know that people travel to, like, get specific vehicles. That's very much a thing.
Yeah. So, I mean, I at this point, I definitely see the police's standpoint. Everything indicates that he's an adult that was planning a trip.
And he is on that trip.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Noted.
It's, like, maybe he just forgot to give his neighbor the key. Totally innocent mistake.
Sure. Noted. Even beyond that, like, noted it's odd behavior for him to do X, Y, and Z. But again, he's an adult and he told somebody that he's going on a trip. Let's wait it out.
Right. But of course, Billy did not return from his trip. So 3 days later, his family filed the official missing persons report. Now, this was shortly before midnight on August 27th. After they filed the report, they went to Billy's home just basically to see if he had shown up.
Who, they? The police?
His family? His parents. You know, at this point, they were hoping that maybe this, quote, trip up north was real. And when they arrived at Billy's house, they were flooded with relief because a light was on at his house. When the Smolinski family went inside, though, they didn't find Billy. Instead, they found Madeline and her friend, Fran Frabel. So again, this is like right before midnight or right around midnight. They had just made a police report. They were like numb, confused, did not know what the hell was happening. So they didn't know what to make of the situation. And so basically they just left.
Okay. So they walk into his house. Now, had anybody taken care of the dog at this point?
Yes, Mary Ellen had, because Mary Ellen had a key because she routinely took care of Harley.
Right.
So the first day, Ellen went over, took care of Harley. I don't know if she probably just took Harley to her house.
Okay. Well, regardless. Okay, yeah. Harley's
fine.
Taken care of.
Mm-hmm.
And then the family walks in and finds his ex-girlfriend
mm-hmm.
and a friend.
Yeah. Her friend, Fran.
I mean, like, what were they doing? Were they drunk? Were they high? Were they?
There's nothing that, you know, has been released that would indicate that necessarily. And, you know, trust me, like, the Smolinskis do not like Madeline. So if that were the case, I'm sure that would have come up at some point. It was just weird. And Bill Smolinski told the Waterbury Observer, quote, "We didn't know what she was doing there. It was real strange," end quote.
I mean, did anybody ask her?
I mean, I'm sure they did. I don't know what she said at the time. I only know what she said later. But that wasn't the only bizarre thing that happened. There was also the issue of Billy's truck. Now, reports differ on this because some say that Billy's truck remained in his driveway when he was on his trip. And other reports say that it was gone. But, like, I have to imagine that it was gone, because if it was there the whole time, I feel like the police would have taken it a little bit more seriously earlier.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, yeah, say you're going on a trip all you want, but if your mode of conveyance is still at the house, like, yes, that would definitely trigger some red flags.
Right. And I have to imagine that it was gone. But in the reports that say that it was gone, they say that it mysteriously reappeared a few days later. And I believe it was after the police report was filed, but I'm not 100% on that. But either way, what is undisputed is that not only was the truck parked at the end of his driveway, which is a place that Billy never, ever parked, but his keys and wallet were placed neatly inside. Now, we don't really have a lot of information about what the police were doing in the early days of this investigation, because, like, I don't think they were honestly doing a whole lot. DNA, like, wasn't collected right away. People were questioned, but not very hard, you know, just kind of things like that. And eventually DNA was taken, but then the samples were lost. Like, it was just a whole thing. The Smolinskis, on the other hand, were papering Waterbury with flyers and searching for Billy in the river, in the woods, anywhere they can think of. Janice Smolinski says that this is something they were doing 7 days a week, every single day. They were out flyering when they weren't flyering. They were searching, you know, on and on and on. They were doing everything that a grieving family desperate for answers would do, and they kept this up for months. In 2005, their relentless flyering and searching did lead to an arrest in Billy's case.
Okay, I'm anxious to hear.
His mother, Janice Smolinski, was arrested.
What?
Now, Janice Smolinski had nothing to do with her son's disappearance, and she was not arrested for having anything to do with her son's disappearance.
Okay.
She was arrested on her birthday, by the way, for trespassing and disorderly conduct for hanging up those missing persons flyers.
Really?
Yeah, if that wasn't bad enough, she was arrested in Woodbridge, which is where Chris Sorensen, the bus boss,
yeah,
is also a local politician.
Wow.
So he lives in Woodbridge and he's a politician there.
What level of politician?
I don't know, because it's different in Connecticut than what we have here. So I forget what the actual office is because we don't have it in Virginia, but it's just some like local board of supervisors type thing.
Okay.
So these charges were quickly dismissed because, you know, I think once it got kicked up, like people were like, what are you doing? Like, this is not a good look. But in 2006, Madeline sued Janice Smolinski and Billy's sister, Paula Bell, for defamation.
What had they been saying up to this point about her?
Well, she claimed that they were targeting her by putting up missing posters near her home and place of business, basically like all around her bus route, and falsely accusing her of being involved in Billy's disappearance. You know, because again, like the Smolinskis constantly talk to the media. There are a lot of news stories. They tried to get as much attention on Billy's case as possible. And according to Madeline, you know, they were accusing her of being involved falsely and just basically ruining her life and like would not leave her alone.
I mean, had they publicly said that, though? Or were they like kind of geo-targeting areas where he was known to be?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's part of it. They did suspect her. They did, you know, think that she was hiding something. So I think they were, you know, targeting her places of business and things like that, because I think they were trying to find anybody else in that area who might have seen something, because they did think that she was involved somehow. This was a whole thing because Madeline had been caught on video ripping the missing posters down. It was this whole thing where they were putting the posters up. They kept on noticing that they were being ripped down. So they started kind of trying to figure it out. And Waterbury police told them, they're like, you know, get it on video if you think that she's ripping them down. And so they did. And sure enough, she was. And then there's even a video of her friend Fran, the one who was in Billy's house with her, repeatedly ripping flyers down right in Janice's face. Like, there's this one video where Janice put up a flyer on a light pole or whatever. Fran came over, ripped it down. Janice put it up again. Fran ripped it down. And that went on like five times before Janice just left.
But why?
Well, from Fran and Madeline's standpoint, Madeline was being harassed.
I mean, I guess I can kind of see that, but at the same time, that just that type of behavior, instead of helping with the investigation of a former boyfriend.
Yeah.
It just optics wise does not look good.
No, especially because when he disappeared, he was extremely upset over, like, you know?
Yeah. And then you end up in his house randomly. Yeah.
And you're one of the last people who saw him alive.
Right.
So this suit, the civil suit that she filed, happened in 2006, but it didn't actually go to trial until 2011. And that trial was a bit of a circus. Like, Bill got up and left during Madeline's testimony. Janice had a breakdown at one point, and accusations were hurled from both sides. Madeline did testify about the midnight trip to Billy's house 3 days after his disappearance and said that she had used a spare key that he had given her and that she went there to get her nightgown and some makeup.
But then why were her and her friend just hanging out?
Well, I don't know that they were hanging out or if they were ostensibly just in the middle of getting her stuff when the family came. You know, I don't know. But she said that she had permission to be there. So the Smolinski's lawyer asked, like, well, from whom? Like, who gave you permission to be there? And she could not answer.
She couldn't even have, like, come up with a quick on-the-spot lie saying that he had given permission?
Well, no, because he had already been missing for 3 days.
Yeah, right, on a supposedly planned trip.
Yeah, but then, you know, then you check phone records, see that he never called her, you know, things like that. So I think she just decided not to answer. So interestingly, Madeline actually won her suit. And although she had originally asked for like $350,000 in damages, she didn't get that, but the Smolenskis were ordered to pay her nearly $53,000 in damages. So they, of course, appealed, but the ruling was upheld by a state appellate court in 2014. Then the Smolenskis were able to take their appeal to the state Supreme Court. And in 2015, the state Supreme Court reversed the appellate court's decision, saying, quote, "We conclude that a new trial is required because the trial court's findings on the plaintiff's claims of defamation and intentional infliction of emotional distress did not consider and are not consistent with the various limitations placed on these torts by the First Amendment," end quote. As far as I could tell, this actually hasn't been brought back to trial since 2015, so hopefully it's just dead.
Unless she's going to really push for it again. Like, what's the point at this point?
Yeah, you mean, but it went on for, 9 years.
Sure, but to continue, knowing that you're not going to get the full amount that you asked for, because you already didn't get that amount, you're probably going to end up paying more in lawyer fees to go through it again.
All right, but getting back to the original criminal investigation, or lack thereof, 18 months after Billy Smolenski went to go up north for a few days, Deputy Chief of the Waterbury Police Department, Jimmy Egan, told The Observer, quote, "Billy was probably having a beer in Europe and would come home when he was ready," what? End quote.
A beer in Europe?
A beer in Europe.
What? What the hell? Why? Oh, God.
Yeah, it's pretty bad.
I mean, the need for a public information officer, holy cow.
Again, this is 18 months after Billy's disappearance. The police had never bothered to give either Madeline or Chris Sorensen polygraph tests. But nevertheless, they crossed both of them off of their suspect list.
Why? For what reason?
Well, I don't really know about in Madeline's case, but in Chris's case, they said that Sorensen seemed, quote, like a real nice guy, end quote.
Okay.
Now, by this time, Billy's parents had already been calling the Connecticut State Police and the FBI, just begging them to get involved because they're like, okay, these police officers, like, they're not doing anything. Waterbury Police, like, they're not investigating this. Because Waterbury had jurisdiction and hadn't actually classified this as a crime, there was really nothing those agencies could do.
Right.
The Waterbury Observer stayed on this story, though, and in 2006 published an in-depth article that included photos of Madeline tearing down flyers. Several months later, the police department finally classified the case as suspected foul play, and the FBI joined the investigation.
That's weird how when you get the public pressure, things can change.
In Madeline's original suit against the Smolenskis, she also was suing the Waterbury Observer, basically for that article. But that part of it got tossed out immediately because they're a newspaper. And that's literally their job,
Yeah.
And they were posting photos that were taken,
right.
It was stupid. So anyway, so that got taken out. But the point is that that article was very scathing. So around the same time, Waterbury police were promising the Smolenskis that they would do a better investigation. So the family asked for a local cemetery to be searched, as Madeline's son Sean used to work as a gravedigger there. They specifically wanted them to check on any graves that had been dug around the time of Billy's disappearance. But the logistics of that, the police didn't really know what to do with that. They're like, how do we bring cadaver dogs out to a cemetery? How do we check these graves, that have actual people's loved ones in them? They just couldn't figure out how to logistically do all of that. So they did nothing. So the Smolenskis did think that the cemetery was a possibility.
What? I mean, yeah.
I mean, it would be a good one,
yeah,
you know?
Absolutely.
But they thought that Woodbridge could also be the answer, where Chris Sorensen lived. So they had asked for the land around Sorensen's home to be searched. but police also did not do that. I think they didn't feel like they had probable cause. Obviously, Chris Sorensen was not going to agree to that, so it just never happened.
Yeah, I mean, not to defend the police in this action of not doing anything, but without a body or any evidence of foul play, that would be pretty difficult to get a search warrant.
Well, exactly. And even though the police had classified it as suspected foul play by this point, I mean, you're absolutely right. Like, there's nothing
suspected
solid.
Foul play versus, like, I mean, they don't even have blood.
Well, exactly.
Anywhere.
And there's nothing solid that points to that piece of property.
Right.
So while those two places were not searched, in 2007, cadaver dogs did go out to a property in Shelton, Connecticut. One alerted, and, you know, so they did dig, but the dogs ultimately did not find anything.
And what was this property connected to?
Well, so it was in a neighborhood. They actually looked at, like, two properties in one specific driveway. And they actually, like, drilled, you know, it was a concrete driveway or whatever. They actually drilled a hole in the driveway.
Well, what I mean is, how is it connected to this case?
Oh, well, it was apparently related to a tip that had come into Crime Stoppers in 2006, so the year before, but it doesn't sound like it was acted on when it actually came through. The tip, along with a lot of other information that was part of the police report, was released to the public via a FOIA request in 2007. According to an article in the Republican American, quote, an Oxford man contacted Crime Stoppers in June 2006 in response to a segment aired about Billy Smolinski. The Waterbury police subsequently interviewed the individual, who preferred to remain unnamed. According to the police report, this individual said that in October 2004, he was told by a close friend of Sean Karpiuk, Gleason's son, so Madeline's son, that Karpiuk choked Smolinski to death at Gleason's apartment. The body was buried at a construction site in Shelton. The grave site was covered with concrete the following day. I basically believe that that's what happened. That's why I went to the police, the man said, who'd once been an employer of Karpiuk. End quote.
That's pretty specific.
Yeah, it's very specific. This is somebody who personally knew Madeline's son, Sean, and had this story told to him by a mutual acquaintance.
Right. Sean, the gravedigger.
Mm-hmm. And he had also worked in construction.
Yeah. So, I mean, like, clearly the knowledge and skill to hide a body.
Oh, by the way, Billy's parents found out about this whole thing in the middle of a Barnes & Noble when a reporter told them.
Tactful on the reporter's part.
Sure. But so it's like this whole thing where they had invited several reporters there. It was like this deal. But yeah, but that's how they found out. Like, the police never told them in 2006. This was never something that they were aware of. They just heard the story from a reporter who had gotten access through the FOIA request. And they're like, oh my God, you're like this, because that was the first thing that they had heard about what had possibly happened to their son. So why would Madeline's son, Sean, kill Billy?
I mean, my first thought would be that Billy was coming over there to either seek revenge or to confront Madeline or Chris.
Yeah, I mean, actually, that's kind of what it sounds like. According to the informant, Billy, who, it should be noted, was about 6 feet tall and 200 pounds, got physical with his mother, so he strangled him. So the story is, Sean strangles Billy in his mother's apartment, and then he called a friend who helped him bury the body. Now, supposedly, this friend is who told the story to the tipster. So this is the mutual acquaintance. Okay, so we have a suspect, so it's time to talk to Sean, right?
One would think.
Yeah, well, it's not that easy. Because by this time, well, one, by this time that this tip happened in 2006, and by the time, you know, it was actually acted on in 2007, Sean was dead.
What?
Yeah, Sean died from a drug overdose in the spring of 2005, less than a year after Billy's disappearance. He was 27.
Okay.
The tipster did also give police the name of the friend, the one who had told him this whole story, but the man was refusing to cooperate with investigators. In 2008, though, they were finally able to get this man, later identified as Chad Hansen, to talk. So he gave them a location of where Billy was buried. But after the police searched and didn't find a body, he recanted his story and said that he made the whole thing up. Police later charged Hansen with second degree making a false statement and interfering with the police officer.
Yeah. Slap on the wrist.
Yeah. Also in 2008, police finally did a proper search of Billy's truck, which his parents had been keeping in storage all this time because they thought there was evidence in it.
I mean, well, that's good.
Yeah. Police found prints, DNA, and hair, but apparently couldn't match them. Like I mentioned earlier, some DNA samples were lost. I think that definitely happened before this. But then there was another time where Waterbury police took DNA, but like didn't know how to enter it into CODIS or any other databases. So it never like went anywhere. It was just a whole disaster. So, you know, they took all this stuff in like October of 2008. And then by June or July or whatever of 2009, hadn't released any results of anything. And yes, DNA takes a long time, but like fingerprints don't.
Right.
Yeah, but apparently they couldn't match anything. So, I mean, I don't know if this is because they didn't have prints for most of their suspects. Because again, like some of them...
Because they weren't treating anybody as an actual suspect.
That's right. Yeah. So I think a few of them, like Sean, I think had possibly been arrested previously, but I'm not even 100% on that. But like Chris Sorensen, he's a local politician. Like he wasn't in prison previously. Like his prints wouldn't be in the system. So yeah. So even though like all this stuff was kind of happening in 2007, 2008, like nothing really came of it. And the investigation petered out. In 2012, the Smolinskys hired a private investigator. And based on what that investigator found, they were able to get the state police to search a site in Shelton where a woman had claimed that she had seen Billy's truck along with a red car shortly after his disappearance.
And the police didn't feel like that was worth investigating?
Well, yeah. So she came forward and like called police with this tip after learning about Billy from the original disappeared episode. But this episode aired in 2010. And yeah, so when she actually called it in 2010, they did nothing. It wasn't until 2012, after they had hired this private investigator, that police are like, oh, yeah. This lady did call in and they took her statement 2 years later. Yeah, again, she hadn't known about the story, but she saw the disappear. She's like, oh, wait, no, like that literally, I saw that truck behind my house and no cars are ever in this spot. So it was extremely weird. So yeah, it was just this whole thing that had stuck out, but she couldn't connect it to anything until she saw that episode, but police didn't care until 2012. So they took a statement, nothing really happened. I mean, they searched the area, but they didn't find anything. Chad Hansen, the guy who said that he had helped bury the body, but then said he had made it up, also reenters the story in 2012. When he fled from a halfway house where he was finishing out his prison sentence, he was eventually caught. And when he was back in court of January of 2013, he was sentenced to another 4.5 years in prison. Now, Billy's family, this was actually a plea deal because he faced up to like 7 years, I think. And so Billy's family had hoped that this would make him talk, but he maintained that he did not know anything about Billy's death.
Why would he talk at that point? He's got his plea deal. He's riding out his drug charges or whatever. And he'd have to hire a good lawyer to specifically spell out immunity.
Right.
And to give a statement. So it would be easier for him to just not say anything.
Yeah. And that's what he did. So after Hansen's confession didn't pan out, the FBI announced that their investigation was over and the case basically died again. But Waterbury at this point had a new police chief. His name was Michael Gugliotti, and he actually did try to revive this case. And he worked with a reporter from the Waterbury Observer who had been doing a lot of investigation on his own. And they were collaborating. They would have these like monthly brainstorming sessions. I mean, it really seemed like it was going somewhere. And, you know, the reporter eventually wrote an article about the whole thing. But Gugliotti abruptly retired in 2013. And so when he left, like the momentum to solve the case was gone once again. An interim police chief eventually came in, but, you know, basically the Smolensis kind of went in hard on him because they, you know, at this point, it's 2013. Their son has been missing for 9 years. The police have screwed up the investigation at every turn. And so basically, the reporter said he was like, I get why they did it. I understand where they were coming from. I, of course, have empathy, but they went in and burned like every bridge that I had built. So the investigation really never regained momentum. What's so bothersome about it is that it seems solvable. Like I said, early DNA samples were lost by the Waterbury police, but the ones in 2008 were sent out by the FBI. Like that was when the FBI was doing the investigation. So they were involved. 2008, the FBI knew how to deal with DNA. And DNA technology has vastly improved since then. So maybe now, if somebody were to take another look at all of this, like maybe there is more of a chance of finding answers. You know, maybe there is some DNA in that truck that doesn't belong to Billy, you know, because obviously they didn't have a sample of Billy's DNA, but Janice gave a sample. So they have familial DNA that is uploaded to CODIS. So they have something that they can test against.
Yeah.
And I mean, Chad Hansen was sentenced to 4.5 years back in 2013. So he should theoretically be out of prison by now. Like maybe he's ready to talk or do something. I don't know. But it, like, there's still so many threads that can be pulled on this. You know, this doesn't seem like a case that's reached a dead end.
I mean, honestly, it doesn't seem like a case that ever took off. There's so many threads and so many loose ends because it doesn't seem like anything was properly investigated.
Right. Yeah. And we see that, you know, so often in these cases that have gone cold where it's like, they shouldn't have, you know, if somebody was dedicated enough, if somebody cared enough, like it shouldn't be cold.
Yeah, because missing persons, we've said it again, it's not a priority.
Right. Billy's family has fought every day to find their son and have been met with nothing but obstacles. Now, back in the intro, which was a long time ago now, I mentioned that there was a connection between Billy's case and that of Heather Teague. So that came with the introduction of the 2009 federal legislation known as Billy's Law. The bill was officially called the Help Find the Missing Act, and Heather Teague's mother, Sarah Teague, was one of its main proponents. The bill's goal was to authorize funding for NAMIS and increase its accessibility. So NAMIS was really in its infancy back then. It also called for sharing information between NAMIS and the NCIC, the FBI's crime database. Because again, part of the problem is that we have all these different databases, all these different resources, but they're not connected. They Correct. Don't talk to each other.
Yes. And not every agency has access to all of these databases.
Right. So a big part of this Missing Persons Act, Billy's Law, was to close those gaps and make investigating these cases easier. Sarah told reporters, quote, there are thousands of families that could be able to bring their children home when these two organizations come together, end quote. Sarah and Janice wanted what all families of missing adults want, for their loved ones' cases to be taken seriously by law enforcement and for law enforcement agencies to have the proper tools with which they can conduct these investigations. Billy's Law aimed to help with that. In 2011, Connecticut Representative Chris Murphy introduced the bill in the House of Representatives. It did not go anywhere. It got kicked down to a subcommittee and just died. It was reintroduced in 2014 and went nowhere once again. Our political climate is much worse than it was in 2011 or 2014.
Sure is.
But this should really be a slam dunk. Like, I don't understand how this didn't get passed. It got kicked down to a subcommittee. It got kind of lost. And then I think what did happen is, like, possibly parts of it did kind of get rolled into other bills. It kind of got cannibalized a little bit. We mentioned in our story about Mary Johnson how NamUs almost had to dissolve recently, but then Joe Biden kind of gave it funding at the very last moment. So, you know, and part of this bill was to further fund NamUs. So that could be part of it. But again, I just feel like this as a standalone bill is so important and it says so much, you know, because yes, the funding obviously is crucial, but the statement it makes of missing adults are important. These cases should be treated with urgency, I think is so, so important. Because the investigatory problem surrounding missing adults hasn't really improved a whole lot since 2014, you know, when this was last introduced. So more can clearly be done, even if parts of this bill have made it into other ones. So if you're in the U.S. right now and you're listening to this and you want to do something to help, like maybe contact your federal representative and ask them about Billy's Law, ask them about this issue, you know, see if we can maybe get something going. Maybe if we can't help bring Billy back to the family who desperately misses him, we can help his legacy live on in a positive way. Billy Siminski has been missing from Waterbury, Connecticut since August 24, 2004. Billy is a white male with brown hair and blue eyes. He is 6 feet tall and weighs approximately 200 pounds. At the time of his disappearance, he was 31 years old. He would be 49 today. Billy has a tattoo of a blue cross with the name Pruitt on his left forearm and a tattoo of a blue cross with an orange outline on his right shoulder. His left ear is pierced with a small diamond. If you have any information regarding the disappearance of William Billy Smolinski, please contact the Waterbury Police Department at 203-574-6941 or the New Haven FBI office at 203-777-6311. You can also email the family directly at info@justice4billy.com, and that's justice, the number 4, billy.com. You can see all the sources for this episode along with photos and videos at our website, andthentheyweregone.com.
And be sure to follow us on social, And Then They Were Gone Pod on Facebook and at ATTWG Pod on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter. If you like what we're doing, please subscribe and consider leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. It will help new listeners find us. And the more people that listen, the more chances we have of bringing someone home.
And we'll see you here next week for a brand new episode.
See you next week.
And Then They Were Gone is hosted by Kona Gallagher and Ethan Flick. All research, writing, and editing is done by Kona Gallagher. Theme music is The Stork by Ketsa. Additional music is provided by Kai Engel. And Then They Were Gone is a Little Monster production.
Hey, you can do it!
If you're a lineman in charge of keeping the lights on, Granger understands that you go to great lengths and sometimes heights to ensure the power is always flowing, which is why you can count on Grainger for professional-grade products and next-day delivery, so you have everything you need to get the job done. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hey, it's Austin James. If you're like me, trying to live your best life while living with diabetes, you can relate to worrying if you're doing a good job managing your diabetes. I use the FreeStyle Libre 3 Plus sensor to get real-time glucose readings and see the impact of every meal and activity to make better decisions. The FreeStyle Libre 3 Plus sensor can help me live life with diabetes on my own terms, and it gives me more time for the things I love, like being a dad and a musician. Now this is progress. Learn more at FreeStyleLibre.us.
For prescription only, safety info found at FreeStyleLibre.us. Americans love using their credit cards, the most secure and hassle-free way to pay. But D.C. politicians want to change that with the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill. This bill lets corporate megastores pick how your credit card is processed, allowing them to use untested payment networks that jeopardize your data security and rewards. Corporate megastores will make more money, and you pay the price. Tell Congress to guard your card, because Americans lose when politicians choose. Learn more at guardyourcard.com.
Member Week is here at Lowe's. Don't miss your chance to get up to 40% off hundreds of items like paint, stain, tools, flooring, and more. Shop our exclusive deals happening in-store and online from May 8th through May 14th. Not a member? Join My Lowe's Pro Rewards for free today and get ready to save more. Lowe's, we help you save. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. Details at lowes.com/terms. Subject to change.